And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. It's my last interview before the summer break and a hot day in Geneva. I'm in the friendly and familiar Warwick Geneva Hotel with my special guest, one of Britain's most well-known political faces, even though he's not actually in the government. Sir Graham Brady is Member of Parliament for Altrincham and Sale West, which is part of Greater Manchester, but particularly well-known because he's the chair of the Conservative Private Members Committee, more popularly known as the 1922 Committee, and we shall learn why shortly. Sir Graham Brady, welcome back to the Geneva, and welcome to the McKay Interview.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here again.
It's great to see you. You just finished addressing the British Swiss Chamber of Commerce at a very successful lunch, and I thank you for making time for me. I take a lot of interest in matters British. I'm from there, so I suppose that's natural. But many of our listeners will not be so engaged. However, they will probably be aware that there have been quite a few ups and downs over the past few years, not by any means forgetting the loss of our dearly loved Queen and the heartening celebration of the new King, Charles III. So we have to give some background and context in our conversation. My first question is, how was Britain when you left it? It has not been an easy country to explain for those of us living abroad who are sometimes asked by locals, friendly locals, what is going on in the UK. And I'm interested to hear how you, being so close to the centre of action, would describe matters in the UK. Sir Graham.
Well, I think we've got a fairly new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, who I think is doing a very good job, working hard, restoring some stability, making it very clear we've got a competent government, which is drawing the line under some of the problems and the turmoil of last year. But obviously doing so always buffeted by events. And clearly this last week or so, we've had the publication of the Privilege Committee report into Boris Johnson and the question of whether he deliberately or recklessly misled the House of Commons. And that's been dominating political headlines. But I don't think it's going to dominate political politics, British politics.
And for those who haven't read it, but may be aware of the headline, just tell us in brief summary what the conclusions of that report were.
The committee found very clearly that Boris Johnson had misled the House of Commons. And it's important to say this wasn't a report into whether parties had taken place in Number 10 Downing Street against the COVID restrictions that were then in force. It's a report into whether the then Prime Minister misled the House of Commons about those events and then whether he did so deliberately. But then the sting in the tail was manufactured by Boris Johnson himself, in that when just over a week ago the committee sent a confidential draft of its report to Boris Johnson for his information and comment, he chose instead to publish a resignation statement in which he rounded on the committee and accused it of being a kangaroo court. So the committee has included in its findings the fact that this, in impugning the integrity of the committee and therefore of the parliamentary process that was involved, this has actually been, in the committee's view, perhaps a more serious contempt of Parliament than the finding they'd already reached that the former Prime Minister had deliberately misled the House.
Just for clarification, misled is gentleman's language for lied to the House.
Well, yes, that's considered unparliamentary language.
In the House of Commons.
Yes. So, but normally we say that people have inadvertently misled the House.
Right.
To have a formal finding that somebody has done so deliberately is very serious.
But it's very serious, yeah. Now, many listening to us will not be familiar with the 1922 Committee. And all I know, apart from knowing you for a few years, is that 1922 is not the full story. It's either 1921 or 1923. But tell us, what is it? And how did it get its name? And what's it for?
Yeah, I've answered this before, Michael, so I think I can do this. The 1922 Committee wonderfully was, of course, not formed in 1922. It was formed in 1923. And the name comes from the fact that in October of 1922, there was a meeting of Conservative backbench, well, actually the whole parliamentary party, Conservative members of Parliament, took place in the old Carlton Club building. And they voted overwhelmingly to say that they wanted the Lloyd George-led coalition, which had taken us through the First World War, right, to come to an end. So the government had no choice but to go to the country and hold a general election. And the Conservative MPs, I think, were proved right in their conviction that the Conservative Party could win a general election alone. It did so. There were a lot of new Conservative MPs elected in that general election. And it was a few months in April of 1923, when the new members of Parliament, the new Conservative members of Parliament, decided they'd get together once a week and have a kind of a self-help group where they'd talk about what was going on, what business was coming up in the House, how they could be more effective. And I think one of the crucial changes, events that happened, they went to tell the Chief Whip, and he very cleverly, instead of seeing this as a putative plot, he saw it as an opportunity. And he said to them, would it help if I sent one of my whips to your meeting every week to tell you what the forthcoming business of the House will be? And that led to the fact both that we always hear the forthcoming business, but also there's always been a whip present at the meetings of the 1922 committee, which I think means that it's always been and was always bound to become really an open channel of communication between the front.
Because the whip carries this information back to the Prime Minister.
Indeed. Yeah. And so do the officers of the 22. We meet with the Chief Whip after our main meeting every Wednesday evening and pass on concerns and thoughts and things
every
that
have
been raised. Every week
we have that
meeting. Yeah. And then the second crucial thing that happened very early in the history of the committee was that other members of other intakes started to say, what's going on in that closed room? Can we come as well? So very soon it developed to be the whole Conservative backbench that would meet together. And so it's really morphed into being the Parliamentary Conservative Party. So it's a historic name, but our function is to try to help the Conservative Party to succeed, to keep Conservative leaders, especially when they're Prime Minister, in touch with opinion in the party, and try to give good advice that might help them to remain Prime Minister.
I see. That's fascinating. Now, this is a rather long question, Sir Graham, but I'm old enough to remember the end of 13 years of Conservative rule, namely the Churchill-Eden-Macmillan-Hume 51-64 administration. I was 16 when Harold Wilson was elected. Now, there were certainly many memorable events that I can recall, even as a boy. Suez Crisis, 57, that was the biggest, the perfumer, sex scandal, the selection of the 40th Earl of Hume, very soon to become Sir Alec Douglas as party leader. I think selection as opposed to election. And of course, Harold Macmillan was ill and eventually stood down. And they ran out of steam and lost the election in 64. But in your era, you've witnessed economic crash, 2008, subsequent recession, Brexit referendum, Brexit itself, COVID-19 lockdown, the unseemly antics and eventual ousting by his own parliamentary colleagues of Boris Johnson, the very brief interlude of Liz Truss as Prime Minister, inflation now and rising cost of living. Now, you personally have been involved in the changing of three of these Prime Ministers. It's a very un-British period of time. We're now in year 13, I come to my question, of successive Tory governments. A general election is likely next year. What is your assessment of the stamina level of the Conservative Party, the most successful winning party in Europe? Does your party have the staying power? The polls show that a large portion of voters is tired of you. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I find on the doorstep that certainly a lot of voters are either tired of the Conservative Party or even a bit cross with us for some of the turbulence that has gone on in recent years. I do find, though, that they tend to have a very high opinion of Rishi Sunak,
really?
The new Prime Minister. Yeah. So I think that the question of stamina is partly one about the leader of the party, the Prime Minister, and I've never seen anybody with the capacity for work and detail and enthusiasm that Rishi Sunak has. I think he knows he's taken on a really difficult job at the most difficult time, but he never seems to flag in his determination to achieve and do the best. And I think his record so far is one which is starting to demonstrate that ability to deliver. And I suppose the first milestone en route was the Windsor framework, where we saw big progress on the relationship with the EU over the Irish border. I think that's been followed through with much warmer relations generally between Britain and the EU, which leads to a much more pragmatic relationship, a desire to make things work and find the best way forward. We've seen on the international front then also the AUKUS treaty happened recently and our accession to CPTPP.
The Pacific.
Indeed, so a big tilt of British influence and involvement to the Pacific region, I think also therefore building relations, building trade relations in some of the fastest growing markets of the world. So I think it's quite an energetic government, and I think that we are going to demonstrate to the public that we can do it and we can regain their faith.
Okay, so this is not intended to sound like a hypothetical question, but ideally, on which terrain, on which battlefield would you prefer to fight the next election as a party?
Well, obviously, I, as they say, it's the economy stupid. So I think improved economic circumstances, albeit much of that is about global factors, and in particular the way that inflation drops out of the system as energy prices come down and the knock-on effect on food price inflation as well. So I think we would hope to be in a position with much lower inflation. Rishi's said his pledge is to halve the rate
he's
of inflation.
He's stuck his neck out on that, hasn't he?
Stuck his neck out, as he did on the question of illegal immigration into the United Kingdom, as he did on starting to get our government debt down, as he has on a number of other very specific factors that he is working to achieve.
And what are your, in your opinion, of the high points of the period Cameron to Sunak? I mean, you've been in the House all through that period. And if you looked as dispassionate as you can as a member of the Conservative Party, what would you say are the really high points?
Well, I think you've got to accept that in government, very often it's not a matter of seeing the excitement and the high points that you would like to see. It's very often about how you can cope with the hand that you're dealt. And so the period in particular of the coalition government, which I wasn't a great fan of coalition, but I have to give credit to the way the government then reasserted sanity in the public finances, started to get a grip of it. The change in the welfare system to bring in universal credit as a system which is far more focused on trying to help people back into work rather than allowing people to stay on benefits, and the improvement in educational standards that were driven through over that period. So certainly some significant achievements there.
Is that really happening? Because I hear news, and I mean, you live in the UK, I don't live there, I'm just reading and listening, watching TV, but large numbers of children that have just seemed to have disappeared from school since COVID. I mean, that must be quite worrying, surely.
You draw me on to what I regard as the lowest point. The lowest point, I think, was the reaction to COVID, which I think we, in common with much of the rest of the world, got very badly wrong. And thank heavens for Sweden, for some American states like Florida, which actually made a more intelligent, more nuanced call in response to COVID, and demonstrate that you didn't need to have the massive economic health and social costs which have arisen from the extreme lockdown policies that were pursued. But a lot of the problems that the Rishi Sunak government is dealing with now are the clear consequences of those lockdown policies, whether it be, as you cite, the hundreds of thousands of children who appear to have disappeared from schooling. Beyond that, the massive numbers who are simply well behind where they would have been if it wasn't for the closure of schools. The fact that we've got literally double the number of people presenting with mental health problems that we had before the pandemic.
It's doubled, is it?
It's doubled. Yeah. We have problems in the National Health Service with waiting lists and backlogs, which are the direct consequence of people who were discouraged from seeking attention, or scans, diagnosis during the COVID period, and who are now presenting with much more advanced illness than would have been the case. And this is a legacy which, along with £400 billion of government spending, which is very much going to colour the politics of Britain for many years to come.
Ms. Bando, I just want to go back to the doorstep story that you were talking a little bit about, and I just want to ask you how you assess the strength of opposition to or difficulty for the Conservative Party across the country. And I'd like to divide the UK into in eight parts. Sounds a bit lengthy, but you'll see why. And I want you to just give me a good sort of cook's tour of how you see the Conservative Party in the home counties, in the west and southwest of England, in the west and east Midlands, in your part of the world, the north, Red Wall, west of the Pennines, your part, including right about in east of the Pennines, the northeast, Tyneside, Teesside, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, the other nations. Just give me a sense of how the party's doing in those, not so much how the party's doing, but rather perceptions that you sense from MPs as to how you're perceived by people.
I think ever since the 2019 general election, that December election, when we secured a majority of 80 in Parliament, but with a remarkable new coalition of support.
Where it's called the Red Wall. Yeah?
Much of it the Red Wall, but we were winning affluent Conservative seats facing Liberal Democrats in the south of England, and we were winning seats from Labour that had never been anything other than Labour in the north of England and in the Midlands. So I think right from that moment, one of the key questions was going to be how a Conservative government would successfully hold together that coalition of support. And it's a very complicated picture, inevitably. So you know, I think the picture in some of the Red Wall seats, whether they were only coming to the Conservatives in order to see Brexit delivered, or whether it was also because they felt in many cases they had been ignored and let down by Labour representation for decades. And I think there's a very strong sense of that that remains. In a constituency like mine, which has never voted Labour, very interesting that in the recent local elections we gained a seat from Labour in a sort of a middling, not the most affluent part of the constituency, but we lost some seats to the Greens and the Liberal Democrats in some of the wealthiest parts of the constituency. So you just have a very, very complex mixture of factors. And one of the things that we can't easily predict is where people are voting Liberal Democrat in by-elections, in affluent home county seats, or voting Green in local elections. Is that actually a pattern of voting behaviour that's going to continue in a general election, or is it a protest that they want to let off a bit of steam and they will then come back? And you know, I think there has to be a very significant element of that, and every chance that we can bring back a lot of those voters to the Conservative fold. The other thing that came out of the recent local elections was that if you look at Labour's national vote share, it was well short of what would be needed to deliver a majority Labour government if a general election had been held on the same day. So not a great set of results for the Conservative Party, but something that should give the Labour Party a real cause for concern.
And the turnout was relatively low, was it?
Turnout in local elections tends to be relatively low. I don't think it was particularly low turnout local election, but certainly not suggesting any enthusiasm for Keir Starmer's Labour Party.
Okay. And just briefly, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, they're special cases, I know, but just for people that aren't familiar with the UK, just give a sense of how you see those parts of the UK.
They are special cases. Northern Ireland doesn't tend to vote in representatives of the mainstream mainland political parties, even though the Conservative Party does organise and stand in some elections there. In Wales, we have a good representation of Conservative MPs at the moment. Boundary changes, though, are very significant, and there's a big reduction in the number of seats there, so that's very hard to predict. Scotland, perhaps, is the most interesting, because after a lengthy period of SNP, Scottish Nationalist Party, control in Scotland, the recent problems afflicting the party, the arrest of the party's chief executive, and investigation into financial possible financial impropriety, and then the arrest of Nicola Sturgeon, the former First Minister. These are things which have really given the SNP a knock. Interestingly, of course, that could result in Labour winning more seats in Scotland than it has in recent history. I think probably most Conservative and Unionist politicians would say that it's probably still worth it, even if that's the case, because we really want to see the Union maintained. And I think it's a very good thing if the cause of Scottish independence is set back.
Yeah. Sir Graham, 13 years ago, Anthony Seldon, Sir Anthony Seldon, as he is now, wrote a book entitled Trust, How We Lost It and How to Get It Back. And perhaps you've read it, perhaps you even know Anthony Seldon. The data showed then, and still does, that politicians, especially those in government rather than local MPs and local councillors, have long been viewed poorly by the general public. But the public's view is at an all-time low right now. And by the way, only just yesterday, I heard Sir Anthony on BBC Radio commenting on yesterday's damning report on Boris Johnson by the House of Commons Privileges Committee, and moreover being very critical of the former PM. But what I recall in particular is when he said, and I wrote it down, our system depends on people at the top to behave with decorum and honour. That's not what he's doing. Why do you think trust has been lost, and how do you think we can get it back? When I say we, I mean in the UK.
I think that, as you say, the level of trust in politics and in politicians has almost always been low in the United Kingdom. Probably it is in most democratic countries. At one level, you can say it's a good thing if people are reasonably sceptical. Don't always take what they're told on trust. I fear that we have moved to a position where the loss of trust is corrosive and actually deters good people from getting involved in politics. Why would you put yourself forward to stand for election if the result was going to be a barrage of abuse on social media? And so I think the balance is horribly wrong. I think obviously there's a lot that politicians need to do to demonstrate that the public can trust them, and I think we need to be very clear in our communications with our constituents. But I think people also need to be a little bit careful about falling into the easy trap of assuming that everybody who offers themselves in public life is untrustworthy, because that, I'm afraid, will be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Okay, well, I can understand that. And my next question follows on from the previous one, comparing difficult political types and styles now, the whole matter of trust. This week saw the state funeral in Milan of Silvio Berlusconi, four times Prime Minister of Italy. Now, I'm not too close to Italian politics, so I can't judge him. But to many Italians, as you know, he was a towering and popular figure. I also read the newspapers and listened to people who know more than I do about Italian affairs, and it seems to me that in his manner of behaviour, his brushes with the law, his dalliances with women, his relationship with the truth, and even his political triumphs, he was Trumpian long before Donald Trump and Johnsonian long before Boris Johnson. And yet, for all his flaws, millions of voters loved him and voted for him, as voters in America and in the UK did for the other two. Why do you think that was and is, and what is it, in your opinion, about these flawed characters that attracts the voters?
I guess they're larger than life. And certainly in the case of Donald Trump and Silvio Berlusconi, I suppose backed up with a serious amount of financial firepower, and in Berlusconi's case, of his own media empire to get the message across.
Yes, but that must help a lot.
I would think that would be quite helpful. But it does appear that Berlusconi was ahead of his time in a way, as you suggest. I remember all those years ago, Tony Blair and his family would go on holiday at Berlusconi's holiday homes, and you know, I guess it also flags this difficult question of how much you deal with politicians that you might not wholly approve of. And I guess an important European country like Italy, important that the British government does deal with. I don't know whether Tony Blair was at the funeral there.
But I was really talking more about the appeal to the voters. It always just puzzles me that there's a fine line between the dangerous demagogue, and we've seen under Tony Mussolini, Adolf Hitler, and other kinds of great orators, we would call them, not demagogues, whether it's Churchill or whomever. And I'm just always puzzled on that very, very fine line.
Well, oratory is rather out of fashion, I think, now. People don't like you to address them as though you're speaking to an audience of 5,000 people.
No, that's true. That's true.
I think the fashion is to address people in their living rooms on the television screen.
That's true.
And that certainly has changed political styles. But I guess Trump in particular was very active in social media, using Twitter and so on. I guess that's a way in which you can communicate very directly with a large number of people. And I suppose, you know, I think social media is one of the things which has done probably most damage, both probably to the style of politics that's encouraged by it, but also to the way in which many voters consume their political information. And people, you know, I fear that social media leads people to make instant judgments without having read or heard the arguments, sometimes to condemn individuals, to be very aggressive in their responses. And you know, it's almost the opposite of what we ought to be encouraging in politics. Well,
there's another point. I had Nick Robinson on my program about 5 or 6 years ago, and he made the point that for many politicians, it's been a real advantage, because one of the things that many politicians objected to in days gone by was having to be mediated through BBC, ITV, whatever. And now with social media, they can leapfrog directly over that. And that must be attractive to many politicians.
Yes, but if you can say it in what, I can't remember how many characters Twitter is, 120 characters or whatever it is, then it may not be always worth saying. But at the same time, in the United Kingdom, we've seen the massive decline of regional media. And certainly when I became a Member of Parliament in 1997, I remember each of BBC Northwest and Granada Television, the independent channel, each of them had two full-time people in the lobby at Westminster. I knew them well, I'd chat to them most days. If I'd just been in the chamber and made a speech or asked a question, I'd come out of the chamber and I'd say, you know, at 23 minutes past three is the time you want to get the clip, and you know, I was asking about an important local or regional issue. And so it used to be the way in which, as a new Member of Parliament in particular, you could establish yourself and get known by your electorate. That's disappeared. Yeah. Now there's nobody from the region in the lobby on a full-time basis.
Two quick questions before we close. You're still a young man, relatively, but I read and heard recently that you're not standing for re-election next time round. You're in your prime. Why are you stepping down?
Because I'm in my prime. I'm very fortunate. Having been first elected 2 weeks off my 30th birthday, I will have served for 27 years in the House of Commons. Huge privilege to serve the constituency where I grew up. I've also had the enormous privilege of being chairman of the 1922 committee, elected by my colleagues, not an easy electorate, for 13 years so far. If they'll have me until the election, then it'll be 14 years. I've had an exciting career, I've had a good innings, and I will be in a position of being able to leave Parliament age 57, I hope still young enough to take some new challenges.
Yes.
And so, you know, I feel good about it.
Good.
And, you know, of course, there are colleagues who choose to stand for election into their 80s, and some of them make a big contribution in public life. But I always think there's a danger that one ends up haunting the corridors of Westminster.
So no farewell Frank Sinatra type concerts for you?
I don't think so. I want to enjoy a bit more variety.
So I'm not going to, last question, I'm not going to intrude on in asking you about your own personal plans, but what do you hope for your party as you look to the horizon, and what do you hope for your country?
Well, I mean, the Conservative Party is a great political party which has governed our country for far more of its history than any other party, including in recent history. I think we have the right core values which chime with those of the British people. So we owe it to the people whom we serve to make sure that the turbulence of the past few years is an aberration, that the move back to a more stable, solid, reliable style of government, which I think we're seeing under Rishi Sunak now, becomes a permanent fixture, because the British public has a right to expect that from the Conservative Party into the future. And, you know, I'm a patriot, I love my country, I think Britain has a great future. I think we're not a great world power in the way that we were. We haven't been actually for a longer time than we used to pretend. But we're still a very important country in the world. We still have a huge amount of soft power and reach. We have relationships through all sorts of different platforms and institutions, and we are generally respected around the world. And I think the tilt that we're seeing at the moment from the government towards the Pacific region is both moving us closer to some of the big growth markets of the world. It's also restoring relationships that have been very important to Britain in the past and moving us closer to some of our allies in the region as well, which is an important geopolitical contribution. Fundamentally, though, Britain has got to be a country that stands for freedom, stands for decency, and for our own people, the opportunity to get on regardless of where you come from.
So, Graham, thanks for making time for me. Thanks for your insights. Thanks for coming to visit us here in Geneva, and we enjoy the rest of your short stay here. I know you're heading back to the airport later. My guest today has been Sir Graham Brady, MP, Member of Parliament for Altrincham and Sale West, and Chair of the Conservative Private Members Committee, more popularly known as the 1922 Committee. Sir Graham, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.